Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. We're going to be talking a little bit today with you about soil. You know, sometimes problems in your garden come from problems with your soil. And we'll deal with that and some other things as well with our guest, Kevin Chesso, back with us. He is talking with us from our studios in Superior. He's the Area Ag Development Agent for UW Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. He also coordinates the Master Gardener Volunteer Program for the Tri-County area. He manages the Teaching and Display Garden at the Spooner Ag Research Station, and he organizes horticulture workshops and field days. We'll talk about improving garden soil and take your vegetable gardening questions as well, and we can also talk about fruit bearing plants with you. So, do you have any problems or questions in those areas? What vegetable varieties are you experimenting with this year? How do they look? Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you. And Kevin Chesso, welcome back. Hey, it's been a while.
Yes, it has, Larry, and thanks for having me back.
It's great to have you back. And let's start by before we go to the phones here and talk about soil. How do you know if you've got healthy soil?
Well, I think anybody who's gardened knows that we can do a lot with just our hands and our senses and watching our plants. And, you know, it's just an intuitiveness, I think, that most experienced gardeners appreciate over time. And it all starts with the soil, as we know. So it's a living organism. Sometimes we forget that. And I think the more we work it, the more we get intimate with it and understand all the parts that make soil healthy and vibrant, the easier it is for us to feel like, yes, I do have a healthy soil and I am doing what I need to keep it that way. And it's a learning process just like anything.
Yeah, just like anything. And, you know, I think it's still good to get a soil test if you have concerns or worries. Maybe you're trying something new, a new type of vegetable or plant, and want to know if that plant's going to survive.
Yeah, a comment I always often make is don't guess, take the test. And there's certainly something to be said about having those analytics on your soil, and they are a collective chemistry analysis of the sample that you submit. So we got to make sure we're collecting a representative sample. And that certainly gives us a baseline to work from. And the soil pH is probably the most critical. And depending on where you are in the state, you might have an acid soil, which is more common in the northern part, and certainly up in the counties that I work in. But, you know, there's other parts of the state where we've got more alkaline parent materials and more basic kind of soils. And if your pH is too high, that might need to be corrected as well. So, yeah, a soil test is always a good place to start. But we can't forget about the biology and the physical properties of soil as well. And that's the other parts that we don't have a specific test that yeah. we're, you know, recommending just yet. I think in the future that could very well be an option.
Oh, you think so?
I think the microbiology and some of the assays that we can do, and I'm thinking way out here now, right?
Yeah.
but you know, we know that there's microorganisms in the soil that are beneficial to plants, and it's just a matter of what do we test for, how do we test it, what's our recommendations based off of a number, and that's all that basic research that happened in the chemistry world of soil science, 100 years ago, and the new frontier, I think, is, in the biology, microbiology of the soil.
Yeah, it's going to be pretty cool, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're starting a garden, let's say an area that hasn't been had a garden before, what do you do in terms of, or what are you recommending in terms of preparing the soil and getting it ready for that garden?
Yeah, well, this is, again, where those senses of, just taking a shovel or a fork, and you can kind of learn a lot about the physical properties of that soil just by digging in it. And, if it's loose and friable, and if it's not too wet, or if it's really dry and, sandy, that's going to you know, indicate another thing. So, you know, you have to do that initial assessment. And, you know, the color of the soil obviously tells us something, too. You know, the darker the soil, the more organic matter we have. And organic matter is obviously good. You know, it holds water. It feeds our microbes. You know, organisms, it's just a good buffer to have in our soil. So the more organic matter we have, the better. So color. And then, you know, that soil test. I mean, there's nothing wrong with, if you're so inclined, you know, once you've got your area figured out and your soil is kind of uniformly mixed, go ahead, take a soil test of it and start with that information. But, you know, I think intuitively there, you're just going to have to decide, you know, should I add compost? Should I add shredded leaves? You know, what kind of materials do I have access to that would benefit my garden soil, especially if I, you know, I'm just starting out? You really can't go wrong with adding organic matter.
And, yeah.
You know, so that's just some of those basics I think you got to think about. And, you know, the plant is going to also tell us if it's happy or not. And, you know, as time goes on, you'll make adjustments and you'll learn about your soil and you'll discover which plants like to grow there and maybe there's others that don't. And, you know, we're given what we're given and you can only change it so much within reason.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man. Well, you know what? We have lots of callers online to visit with you. Still have one open line at 1-800-642-1234, but let's get going with the phones here. Mary in Lodi, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Good morning, Larry. Thank you for taking my call. We have raspberry beds that last year were just very prolific. I think I got a gallon bag, freezer bag full of them. And this year, I've got a lot of nice, healthy plants, but they're almost, I've got a handful so far. Almost none of them have even gotten blossoms on them. And I wonder if that's a result of the cold spring, or maybe I need to amend the soil, or maybe there's too many of them and I need to thin them out. So yeah. What are your thoughts?
Sure. Well, I'm assuming these are summer raspberries, or are these fall? Do you know what type of raspberries?
These should be summer raspberries. That's when
okay, they... Okay. And raspberries bear on two-year-old canes. So the first year they grow vegetatively, and that's the primal cane. And then the second year, they'll produce the flowers on the floral cane. And if we're not having enough of those floral cane, those two-year-old plants make it through winter, we won't have, you know, canes that have fruit. So that would be the first thing to consider is, you know, did you lose some of those primal canes that grew so vigorous last year? And they didn't overwinter, or, you know, there's something happened to that. Now, if you have lots of primal floral canes, the two-year-old ones, and they're not flowering, this time of year you should see plenty of flower buds and plenty of fruit. It's late enough for our summer bearers to have fruit on them. So, I don't know. Do you know which kind you have?
No, I don't. They were here when we bought the house.
Ah.
I'm wondering, I cut them back last year. Maybe that damaged the older ones, and I've just got a whole batch of youngsters.
Yeah. Do you know, did you have fruit on last year, and what time did the fruit appear?
Oh, we had tons of fruit. We've still got some in the freezer. And we actually got like a winter or a fall crop, and some of the younger plants actually blossomed and produced fruit late last year. So we almost kind of had two crops last year.
Okay. Well, I'm wondering if you might have the fall-bearing raspberries, possibly. But I guess I can't say exactly why a summer-bearing wouldn't be bearing fruit at this time of year unless all those floral canes were pruned out and you're just left with the primal canes.
Yeah, could be. So that's something I think, well, you know, next year, I mean, I don't think I'd do anything to it this year, would you, Kevin? I'd just wait and see what happens next year.
Well, if you got healthy one-year-old canes, those should be next year's crop. And for whatever reason, you didn't have a lot of those fruit floral canes this year. So that's my first area that I would investigate because there's something obviously that prevented that fruit from appearing.
Yep. Thanks, Mary. Appreciate the call. Judith in Turtle Lake, we turn to you next. Hi, Judith.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question and a comment for Kevin.
Okay.
Kevin, I've inherited a lot of growing space, as you're well aware, and I'd like you to talk about the benefits of green manure and the advantages of something like rye over something like buckwheat.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd also like you to mention when your Twilight Garden Tour is.
Yeah, we're going to talk.
I will hang up and listen to your answer.
All okay. Right.
Thank you so much, Judith. I think I know who this is. And thank you so much for calling in and asking these questions. And cover crops, green manures, a living root is often referred to. Keeping the soil covered, having a living root is much better than bare soil. So sometimes when, life happens and we overcommit or we can't put in this much garden space as we've once done in the past and we have all these kind of vacant garden beds, the best thing we can really do is to keep that soil covered and intentionally plant cover crop species. And, that's going to be much better than just letting the weeds come up, which they will. So cover crops, there's all kinds of different types that we can, use in the garden. And rye, buckwheat, there's clovers, any number of them are suitable. And specifically rye versus buckwheat. So buckwheat, it's a broadleaf. It's a very common plant. It grows up fairly tall, gets little white flowers. It's very good at self-seeding, so you can get a second crop or a volunteer crop of buckwheat the next year if you're not careful. It does attract some bees. It's got the flowers for the pollinators, so that might be a benefit of buckwheat. And rye, the types of rye that most people plant are probably going to be the winter rye variety or the cereal rye. And what I like about rye is it's got a very vigorous, fibrous taproot, root system, and that's all going to build up the organic matter in the soil. So the grasses, their fibrous root system, they're a little more dense in covering the soil. They have a little bit more advantage over, say, a buckwheat that's more upright. The buckwheat's going to decompose a little quicker, but it does have the flowers. So, both are very good, and I don't see one as having a better advantage over the other. The disadvantage of winter rye is you've got to figure out how you're going to terminate that crop in the spring. Otherwise, you're going to have a rye field come July. So cover crops are excellent thing to intentionally plant in our vacant garden beds so that, we're building the soil, keeping it covered, and hopefully suppressing weeds.
Good answers there. Let's go to Steve in Mount Pleasant next. Hi, Steve.
Oh, I have heavy clay soil with a 7.5 pH, high in zinc, lousy tilth. And I've got another question about grapes.
All right.
Okay.
So, how do you modify that clay soil? No, I was asking Kevin to for his thoughts.
Well, there's a saying that I maybe overuse, and maybe it's not quite correct. But I always say there's three things that you can do to improve most soils, and the number one thing to do is add organic matter. The second most important thing we can do is add organic matter. And what do you suppose the third most important thing we can do? I know it's oversimplifying, but we do know that organic matter over time will improve all kinds of properties in the soil. And that soil tilth, the resiliency to compaction is going to slowly over time improve. And it's just something we have to be patient with. And our challenge with these clay soils is you really have to do everything humanly possible to stay off of them when they're wet. And, we can mulch and walk on mulch paths and use raised beds and avoid excess tilling. And that's where I'm real a fan of going to raised bed gardening, especially on these clay soils, because you can confine your gardening where your plants are into these beds, you know, 2, 3, 4 feet across, however long you want to make them. And then you walk around them and you reach in, so you're never really stepping on the soil. And then by mulching the garden beds with any number of mulch materials, you're going to be continuously adding, you know, that organic matter. So that's going to help loosen up the soil over time. But it takes years and years to do that. And I think changing our gardening practices might be in line here, depending, again, on how you're approaching this. And you said your pH was 7.5?
Correct.
Yeah. So now we're above the range that we like to have our soil pH for most plants. And we really need to think about ways we can reduce that. And, you know, just like with soils that are too acidic, we can add amendments. And in this case, we want to basically add maybe aluminum sulfate or elemental sulfur. There are organic materials that might be high in acidity, you know, like sphagnum moss or perhaps fresh pine needles or other acidic type organic matter. Over time, fertilizer will actually do the same thing. We know additions of nitrogen fertilizer over time will slowly acidify the soil too. But I think with a pH of 7.5, you got to be a little more intentional and look for, you know, those products I mentioned, like aluminum sulfate or elemental sulfur, to get that pH to go down.
Yeah, makes good sense. Thanks, Steve, for calling. Appreciate your call. Kevin Chesso, our guest, the Area Ag Development Agent for UW Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. He does a whole lot of things there. He manages the teaching and display garden at the Spooner Ag Research Station, organizes horticulture workshops and field days, does all kinds of things. It's great to have him with us. And also great to have Dave Potratz, our engineer, and Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Kevin Chesso, and there's one open line at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Rich in Wanakee next. Rich, thanks for calling. Appreciate your call.
Yeah, my pleasure. Hey, thanks, Larry. Hi, Kevin. So it was a really good segue, actually, your last call into my call. I've recently had a desire. I've gotten into pie making, and I want to have fresh fruit for my pie making. So I've planted some blueberry plants, but before I did that, I got some soil testing done through the UW lab, and I've been dealing with a guy named Andrew, because this particular plot of soil that I'm talking about had a pH of like 7.4, and my understanding is like things like blueberries and rhododendrons and stuff like that need a soil down like 5.5 for a pH. So I did add about 8 pounds of aluminum sulfate to an area that's about 120 square feet. I waited 30 days and I had that soil retested. It came down to a 6.9, my pH. And Andrew, I followed up with a phone call with Andrew at UW Soils Lab, and he said that that would take more time to bring it down further. I debated keeping that ground fallow, but I decided to put in 2 blueberry plants, and they're responding well. And I was just wondering if Kevin could tell me any more about how long that reaction with that aluminum sulfate may take to bring things down.
Well, I'm so glad that you're doing your due diligence and trying to be proactive with this. Oftentimes, people plant their blueberries knowing that they got to have their soil acidified, and then they think, oh, it's not that high, and then after the fact, they try to change the pH after the plants are in the ground. The best time to prep and do all this soil amendment and bringing that pH down is at least a year in advance. Now, for most people, that's hard to plan that far ahead, but what's going on here is really basic chemistry. And when we look at chemistry in a test tube or in a liquid form in a lab, things are dissolved and they interact with each other quite rapidly. In a soil system, we've got sand, silt, clay, organic matter, all these other, you know, particles that kind of interfere with those chemistry molecules from interacting. So, you know, the more mixing we can do, obviously infiltration and water flow through there is going to help move things around and get things to react with each other. So 3 months is, you know, I'm not surprised you saw some changes, but I would agree that this is at least a year process to fully get that chemistry to happen. And it works the same way with agricultural lime or liming our soils to bring the pH up. It's the same basic concept of getting those particles to interact. And in a soil system, it's just so much harder to do that without intentionally mixing it. And so it's just a waiting game. Your plants certainly will indicate if you're in the zone. And as time goes on, I think your plants will just look healthier and healthier. And then in another year, maybe 2 years, you do another soil sample and you verify where you're at.
There we go. Good luck, Rich. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Marty in Douglas County, we go to you next. Hi, Marty.
Hi, good morning. Well, soil testing was not at all on my radar this morning, but now I'm going to get a soil test. Thanks for that. Can we just tippy-toe back into the cover crop discussion?
Sure.
Can you just give me a few more details? So if I plant some cover crops on these new beds we've got right now that we don't have anything in, so what do? We wait until they grow and then we till them under? How does that, what's the rest of that story?
Sure.
Yeah, you know, this is where, you know, how intentional do we want to be about building our soil organic matter through cover cropping? And obviously we can add other amendments like our composted leaves, you know, animal manures, you know, and there we're kind of, you know, jumping ahead and got composted, decomposed materials. When we're growing our organic matter more intentionally with a living plant, not only do you get the residues that come from the plant tissue, but you get all the interactions that happen underground with the plant root and attracting some of those microorganisms that are connected with the root rhizosphere. So living mulch and living cover crops and green manures have added benefits. So if you've got the time to do that, you know, it just like with the last question, you know, it takes maybe a year to get all that stuff worked in and see the benefits. So if you want to be more intentional about it and plant those cover crops, knowing that they're going to grow all season long because you want those roots to get well established and have that interaction with the soil and the microorganisms, you know, that's where you can actually fallow a couple beds and grow your cover crops one season and then rotate and, you know, just have different beds where you are constantly using cover crops to kind of build your soil. But now those beds are not going to be productive in the fact that they're growing a vegetable or some kind of flower, whatever your intended, you know, crop is. So there is a publication that UW Extension has on the Learning Store. And I don't have it right in front of me, but it's, I think, just cover crops for gardens. And in there, it goes through some of the details on how to do cover crops in your garden and the types of cover crops that you might look at using. But it pretty much spells out, you know, the concepts and what to do, just like all of our publications. They're very user-friendly and how-to and, you know, short and sweet. So that publication on cover crops in the home garden or something to that effect would probably be the one you want to look at.
Yeah, it's learningstore.uwex.edu, I think, is the proper address for it. But if you put in UW Extension Learning Store, it's probably going to pop up just as well. And then, you know, once they've run their course, you know, you do work them in, don't you, Kevin?
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, you know, and this kind of runs a little bit counter to my, you know, add more, till less concept of building soil and making healthy soils. But kind of like that aluminum sulfate and the carbonates with the lime for, you know, pH changing, There is some benefit to incorporating those residues and letting the microorganisms interact with them. And that's where I said just shallow tillage. Doesn't have to be super aggressive, you know, just a light tilling just to kind of get some soil to come in contact with those plant debris is all you're looking for. But, yeah, certainly helps.
And Rick in Eau Claire has something relating to this as well. Let's go there. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Larry. How you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
So I got to witness the benefits of this idea firsthand here in Eau Claire at the Chippewa Valley Tech College. We had a high tunnel that was placed pretty much over a construction site where it was already clay soil to begin with. And over the year and a half of construction, many, you know, high-sized implements, you know, had driven over it while they were constructing the building. And so this high tunnel was pretty much, you know, centered over concrete. And what we did was the first year, we tilled it as best we could. That was an all-day process to do a 50 by 30 high tunnel. And we broke the soil up just enough to plant our first set of cover crops. And then over the year, we let those grow. We cut them down. We retilled them in lightly, like your guest was saying. And we planted another cover crop. And over 2 years, we went from having a 6-inch penetrating layer where we had a seed bed to well over 12 to 14 inches deep just from root action growing and, you know, just letting Mother Nature break the soil up on its own.
Wow, that's great, isn't it, Kevin?
Oh, I love those personal validating stories because that's how we all learn and we can share that experience and it becomes real. You know, you can read this stuff in the textbook, you can take classes, you can get all the theory and the science and biology, all that nerdy stuff I think it's awesome, you know, and I really enjoy that. But when, you know, the rubber meets the road, so to speak, is when it's in practice in backyards and out in fields and, you know, in high tunnels like Rick just explained. And that's what programs like this are all about, is just sharing that experience and that science-based knowledge so that we can feel confident that there is hope in improving our situation, right?
And they did it in pretty short order, really, when you think about it. You think about the challenge they had there with the heavy equipment driving over it, and then in 2 years they were able to make a huge difference.
Yeah, and it's only going to get better. I mean, obviously there's an equilibrium you reach at some point. You can overdo it. I mean, you can put too much organic matter into a soil, and it gets, especially if it's got a rich nutrient content like a composted manure, you know, you can get too rich a soil and have too much of a good thing going. But for most people, I think, you know, you understand where that equilibrium is and you start to maybe back off or focus your efforts someplace else. But, yeah, I'd say just keep doing the right thing and treating our soil like it's alive, you know, organism, which it is. And I think we'll all be better off and our plants will, too.
Rick, thanks again for calling. Yvonne in Shatak, it's your turn. Hi, Yvonne.
Hi. I'm calling because I've been reading at my public library, and in the grocery store I saw a thing about the Twilight meeting on Tuesday, August 14th, starting at 3 up at Spooner. And I was hoping that Kevin could tell me more about it. And I understand you're even going to have some things to eat. Could you describe that a little?
Sure. And I've been anxious to kind of revisit this topic after Judith mentioned it, and I forgot all about it. And just waiting for that radio moment to jump in here. But you're right. The Spooner Ag Research Station, in partnership with UW Extension and our UW Extension Master Gardener Volunteers, puts on an annual event in August. This year it's August 14th. It's at the Teaching and Display Garden. It's on the Spooner Ag Research Station property off Orchard Lane, just north of Highway 70. There'll be signs up directing people there, and it's our big kind of open house. We'll have speakers and demonstrations, and it's just a wonderful time to come out and share your gardening stories. This year, our specialist that will be helping with our program are some UW Extension folks. Some have been on Garden Talk before. Mike Maddox will be there.
Yeah, Mike's been around many times.
Yeah, Aaron Silva.
Yeah.
And Julie Dawson.
Great.
So those are our guests, and we do have sampling of different vegetables that are coming both from the Teaching and Display Garden and our Seed to Kitchen. So, yeah, come on out. It's free, open to the public. Official program starts at 4.
4 to 7:30, and I know there's everything from flower arranging, the honeybees, the shiitake mushrooms. You mentioned the vegetable tasting and grilling. That sounds like fun. The organic vegetables, another topic, and table and wine grapes, and the Cable Natural History Museum, part of all that, too. So it sounds like a lot of fun to me. Tuesday, October 14th from 4 to 7:30 p.m.
August.
I'm sorry, August 14th.
Yeah. You can come in October. I mean, the garden's still open.
How did I say October? How did that get into my head? August 14th at the Spooner Ag Research Station. I love that station. I haven't been up there in a while, but I've always enjoyed visiting the Spooner Ag Research Station. It's a great place. Well, Yvonne, thanks a lot for bringing that up. We'll try to remember to bring it up again during the show at some point just to remind folks and those who just tune in late. George in Wausau up next. Hi, George.
Hey, hi, Larry. Say, I just wanted to mention something regarding the raspberries that the lady had a problem with in terms of poor production. I had a similar experience back last fall. I was looking at my beautiful canes and, dreaming about raspberries for this year. And by the time March rolled around, found that most of them had been gnawed on by the large bunny in the backyard. And the reason I know that is that she left some presents there, which helped to fertilize the ground. But anyway, this year I'm going to put up a nice rabbit fence to keep her out.
There you go. Kevin, and that's always an issue, isn't it?
Oh, yes, yes. And this is a good concept I like to remind people too of is, I call it horticulture CSI, crime scene investigation. Something happened. You know, it's obviously you made note of it. Maybe it's a little after the fact, but now we got to go back to the crime scene and look for evidence and try to put the pieces of that together and come up with a likely suspect, right? And in this case, there was some obvious telltale signs and droppings, perhaps, that really got our attention and said, aha, that's what happened here. So we always have to do our due diligence. We can't jump to conclusions. And that's that critical thinking that, I think we're all capable of doing. We just sometimes let our emotions get in the way and we jump to conclusions we shouldn't. And with gardening, there's all kinds of opportunities to do horticulture CSI.
Brad in Mount Vernon, let's go to you next. Hi, Brad.
Yeah, hi. Enjoy your show as always. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a new garden. We just built a new home in the country a year ago, and I had to log off a lot of black walnuts, and I had the excavator dig out the stumps and bury them in a different location than the garden's in. And I hauled in two truckloads of, garden compost on one of them and just topsoil on another. And what I'm noticing this year, the corn is doing real good, but most everything else seems to be kind of stunted. And I'm wondering if it's still a reaction to the black walnuts that were here originally or if something else might be going on.
Well, again, getting back to that CSI concept here, you got to kind of think back and, what's the past history, what kinds of things might, be causing some, challenges with the growing plants. And certainly the black walnut toxicity is something that we, it's well known. It's this, juglone that they have. It's in their roots. It's in their sap. It's in their leaves. And there still could be some of that residual that's in the soil that might be causing some toxicity issues with our plants. And, how do you dilute that out or how long it takes for it to kind of get out of the soil? I don't know exactly for sure how long that takes. But, given that this is a new garden, There's a lot of different things that have to kind of happen to mellow out that soil and get it so that it's in a state for growing happy, healthy plants. And, you know, so I wouldn't rule out the jug loan.
They can last for years, I think, in the soil.
Yeah, and the other thing, you know, we talked about this already, is at some point, you know, maybe you do your soil test and you just see what that chemistry looks like. And then, you know, make adjustments to the pH if you need to, and then just keep adding your organic matter and doing the normal kinds of things you would think you'd need to do in that spot. And, you know, just keep watching your plants and hopefully, you know, over time, you know, it doesn't happen overnight. Your soil is going to get to a state where it's, you know, growing the kind of plants you want. You know, fertilizer, fertility, all those things are going to impact plant growth, and perhaps, you know, there's not quite enough of it there. I'm only guessing here because, you know, yeah. I don't know the situation, but...
There we go.
Yep.
Raised beds are another option if, you know, if it's... if all else fails. And actually, Erin emailed. She's got some raised bed. This is her first year growing vegetables in her backyard, and she used the earth boxes or raised beds. And her peppers aren't doing well. They stopped growing height wise, and the flowers are frying and falling off. There's no fruit. Wondering what might cause that.
Well, in a raised bed. You know, there's a little bit different environment that the plant is experiencing than if it was in the ground. And now this was in one of those earth box kind of containers.
Yep.
Yeah. So, you know, typically water, if it's the ones that have the reservoir in the bottom, water isn't necessarily going to be an issue if it's maintained. Sometimes soil temperature can get a little high in our raised boxes, especially if it's sitting on a deck, full sun. You know, so that soil temperature and the microclimate that's in that box might not be conducive for setting flowers. Flowers will abort if they're not in, you know, for whatever reason, they're not happy. And I don't know all those temperature regime details, but typically, you know, once we get above 85 degrees, that's not good for our plants, including the flowers. Sometimes our night temperatures will influence flowering and flower set. So there might be something going on with the microclimate and that environment of being in a box. That would be my first kind of CSI question. and then you got to start looking at other potential things that might be going on in the soil, perhaps. But in a lot of times, I find that people who are doing raised beds, they have the ability to add so many nutrients and compost and maybe a little bit of Miracle-Gro kind of potting soil or organic fertilizer, whatever they're using. It doesn't take much in a small container to really enrich our soil. So a lot of times fertility isn't a huge factor. You know, pH we always got to be concerned of. But I wonder in this case if it isn't just that, some of that temperature issue that might be happening in that raised box.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. Kevin Shesso, our guest, Area Ag Development Agent for UW Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Kevin Shesso, Area Ag Development Agent for UW Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties. And we have lots of callers online. I think we'll just go right back to the phones and to Connie in New Lisbon. Connie, hello.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have a comment. I spent 4 years trying to enrich my garden. Where I live is very heavy sand and clay. And really the only thing I was able to get to go were green beans. So now instead of raised beds, I use my old feed bags for my animals and garden in those, and it's been going really well.
So you fill those bags up with soil?
Soil and compost and reuse some material kind of from year to year.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's interesting. That, you know, just goes to show that, you know, you got to keep trying different things, and if things don't work the way you like them, you know, that's what I love about gardening. We can always, it's most annual crops, we can mix things up, change things up. And in this case, you know, you tried. And I suppose there's an underlying reason why things weren't working quite so well for you. But growing things in containers such as bags, I've seen that done. You just take a bag of compost, assuming it's, you know, the right kind of compost. You can slit the bag open and plant your transplant right into that bag and just lay it on the ground. As long as you keep it watered, you know, maybe you got to throw some mulch around the base of the plant in the bag to hold in some of that water. But lots of different ways to grow plants, and the creativity that gardeners have is, you know, almost endless. So, you know, we're very resourceful. You've got bags. Why not grow them in a bag?
Yeah,
so I don't see any. Very, very good idea.
Somebody else was telling me about taking chicken wire and making cylinders, making a, I don't know how large the cylinder was, but then putting in the, some of the soil or compost and whatever they had in the, for about a third of the way up, and then threw in some seed potatoes and then filled up some more, and then there was more seed potatoes and all the way to the top. And the plants themselves grew out the sides through the chicken wire.
Yeah.
And then in the at the end of the year when you want to harvest, you just take the wire apart where you had it joined, and it falls down, and there's all your potatoes right there.
Excellent creative gardening right there, right? Just like I was saying. And there's lots of different ways I've heard this same concept done. And, you know, it's like, again, if you understand the plant, you know, I always say right plant, the right place. And, you know, if you know how potatoes grow, you're thinking, well, wait a minute, why should I, you know, bury them in the ground and then shovel them and heap up all this soil around them and do all that extra work? You know, there's got to be a better way, you know, especially in the backyard, a small scale. And, you know, so perfect. You know, the other concept I've heard of is using, you know, 5-gallon bucket or other kind of container with the bottom drilled out or something, or tires. Now, you know, some people don't like the fact that there might be some, you know, some things leaching out of those tires. But, you know, you stack up tires, you can kind of do the same thing. You know, it's lots of different ways.
Yeah, I had some leftover straw from my straw bales this spring, you know, from leftover from last year, and I piled it all up in a pile, and I threw some seed potatoes in there, and they grew really well. So I, you know, I was using last year's straw bales, one of the remnants, for my seed potatoes this year, and it worked pretty well.
Yep, that's, again, that creativity you got there, Larry.
Let's go to Cindy in Madison. Hi, Cindy. Cindy, are you there? Cindy had, I think we might have lost her. She had, Oh, are you there, Cindy?
Yes, I'm sorry, I hit the wrong button.
Oh, okay.
Yes, I have a compost pile, and I had let it sit for over a year and recently turned it. I had beautiful, beautiful compost, and then I realized I have a whole bunch of jumping worms in it because I had used a lot of leaves and things that they like in that compost pile. So now I'm wondering, how do I use that compost without spreading it everywhere in my garden, without spreading the jumping worms everywhere in the garden?
Yeah, Madison is unfortunately a jumping worm, getting to be a jumping worm hotspot, Kevin.
Yes, and I became aware of this unfortunate situation about 4 years ago and learned a little bit about it. And for those people who are unaware, just like we have all kinds of other non-native, invasive, you know, organisms that aren't necessarily beneficial in however you want to define that, but they're a very, very aggressive species of worm that will just chow down not only dead material, but they have also the ability to eat plant roots, and super aggressive and cleaning up all that duff and whatnot. So, yes, jumping worms are something we definitely don't want to encourage. From what I know about, you know, worms is, you know, not only do you have the live worm itself, but you've got eggs and pupae and all the other, you know, just like a weed, right? You know, how do you sterilize that compost now so that you know there are no living jumping worms or egg cases or little tiny worms? And I can't think of really any easy way to do that other than trying to solarize it, being very intentional to heat that compost up. Depending on how much you got, you know, maybe you just put it all into big black plastic garbage bags, the big heavy-duty kind, and tie it shut and just set it out in the baking sun for days and days. It should get hot enough to kill off. You know, I don't know exactly what temperature we're looking at. Probably 140 to 150 degrees would be adequate. But that's probably the best thing you can do to really feel like you've done your due diligence to you know, kill off this unwanted, you know, worm.
That's a good idea, actually. I don't know what there are no chemical treatments or anything that I know about.
There's all kinds of crazy things we can do with, the more toxic kind of fumigants and, you know, different things that will kill off just about anything. But you don't want to mess with that. Just keep it simple. Get the temperature up high enough. Again, on a small scale, I'm sure there's ways you can figure out how you might do that. It's going to be inconvenient. Take a little extra time. You know, you had to wait all this while to get that compost, and now you got this. So that would be my suggestion.
There you go, Cindy. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate it. And Dean in La Crosse, we'll go to you next. Hi, Dean.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Kevin. I've had a well-established raspberry patch now for 5, 6, 7 years. And this year, I had an issue where the taller stalks tipped over about halfway up the stalk. And I thought, well, my initial thought was, well, they're just loaded with berries. But then when I started looking to where they tipped, there was a hole punched through it, like someone had taken a nail and just punched through it and made a perfect hole.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what would be causing that.
My guess is it's an insect, raspberry shoot borer, something to that effect. And I think it's a flying beetle-like critter, and they go in there and they'll maybe chew a little bit on that spot, or they'll have a way to, you know, lay their egg in there. And once the egg hatches, of course, you've got the larvae and they begin to feed. And then that's just like the cutworm, except it's higher up on the plant. The tip, you know, above that injury tends to break off. So this goes back to, you know, going back and looking at that crime scene and seeing if you can see evidence that there was some kind of insect damage, most likely from an egg that hatched, and now it's in there, you know, doing its thing, chewing on the cane, and eventually, you know, just, and sometimes you'll get this crook necking that you'll see maybe because it's not completely, you know, severed off, but that would be my first suspect.
Yeah, there's some problems with raspberries in Wisconsin now. There's an insect that's creating all kinds of issues for a lot of commercial raspberry growers.
Yeah, and that's impacting the fruit.
Yeah.
Right. The symptoms or the signs that Dean just explained, you know, had to do more with the vegetation and the fact that he's seeing these, you know, plants tipping over, and perhaps it's related to this insect I just mentioned. But, you know, if not, you know, now you've got to, you know, do a little bit more due diligence and figure out, well, is it something related or whatnot? But, the spotted-winged Drosophila, which is a fruit fly, is what is causing all kinds of heartache in mostly raspberries, especially the summer and fall-bearing raspberries. And it's just one of those unfortunate, again, another non-native insect that's, you know, kind of causing us some issues. And, you know, the little devils know how to lay eggs in the fruit before it's ripe or as it's ripening. And if you're unfortunate enough to have it, you're going to have little tiny maggots in your fruit. And that's not a good thing for most people.
No, it isn't. Japanese beetles, Colleen in Cumberland, had problems with those. Her grapes were hit really hard. She wonders if she should treat the soil for the grubs that may be back next year. But she has free-range chickens and doesn't want to use anything toxic. You know, I think it's pretty difficult to get rid of those Japanese beetles because they can fly in from so far away, Kevin.
Yeah, and this is another one of those situations where if you've got them, you know the challenges that you face. They come out in such large numbers, especially this time of year. And, you know, it's just a matter of figuring out what's your tolerance to whatever it is they're annoying you with, you know.
Yeah.
So in this case, if they're inundating your grapes, grapes at this time of year can take all kinds of defoliation, so I wouldn't worry about necessarily trying
much.
To kill them. So.
Okay. Kevin Shesso is our guest today on Garden Talk. He's the Area Ag Development Agent for UW Extension in Brunette, Sawyer, and Washburn counties, and he also coordinates the Master Gardener Volunteer Program for that tri-county area as well. Our guest on Garden Talk. Here on the Ideas Network, I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here, and our guest today, Kevin Shesso, the Area Ag Development Agent for UW Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. And here to answer your gardening questions, how's your garden doing this year? Give a call at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Kevin, we had Andy in Eau Claire email us to say he and a friend have an ongoing debate about adding Epsom salts to the hole before you plant a tomato. One of them says he likes it. It basically helps. The other one says it doesn't really help. What do you think?
Well, here's another case in point where we have to ask ourselves the question, you know, why would we want to do that? You know, and Epsom salt is a chemical. It's got, I want to say calcium sulfate. Don't quote me on that. I'm trying to figure it out right now with my little computer here, trying to look up Epsom salt to know exactly what that chemistry is. But anytime we add amendments to the soil, we have to ask ourselves, you know, what's the pros and cons, and is it immediate return on investment, so to speak, kind of that whole thing with that soil chemistry again and how quickly it interacts. This is another case in point where, you know, you could say nothing ventured, nothing gained. And how do you actually quantify that Epsom salt is doing what it's supposed to do? And, you know, that's where a little backyard research or demonstration, you put, you know, one hole with the Epsom salt in and one without, and, you know, just watch the plants and try to see if you see a difference. So I guess, you know, I wouldn't know how to settle this argument without encouraging them to do a little bit of that backyard research and figuring out how Epsom salt might benefit a plant. Somebody's going to call in and say Epsom salt is XYZ, and I just can't find it right now.
You can join in, by the way, with your own questions or comments or maybe an answer on that Epsom salt at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. Just on the tomatoes yet, Kelly emailed to ask how she can get rid of tomato blight in a raised bed.
Okay, so we got to make sure we're talking about the right kind of tomato blight. I mean, there are two types that are very common on our solanaceous plants, and the most common that we find every season is early blight. And it's similar in its symptoms to septoria leaf spot. But these are the diseases that pretty much work from the bottom of the plant up and you get the yellowing and the spotting and leaves fall off, and the next thing you know, the whole plant is infected and, you know, your tomato crop might be lost. But the other one is late blight, and late blight is much different in its symptoms, and it will literally melt the plant in a matter of days, and that's the one that's really devastating to our commercial potato industry in Wisconsin. So we definitely want to make sure we're not allowing late blight to get established. So, you know, that would be my first kind of just, you know, let's do our due diligence here. I'm going to make the assumption here that, you know, this is our more common early blight. And whenever we have diseases, we got to, you know, and I think of Brian Huddleston, right, Dr. Death, yeah, who's been on this show many times, you know, there's the disease triangle. You got to have a susceptible host, you got to have the pest present, and you got to have the right environment. And there's certain things we can do culturally to change some of that, and the environment being, okay, we're going to keep it open and airy, and we're going to put some mulch down and whatnot. But once the pest is there, once you've got that disease spore in the soil and in the local environment, it's always going to be at risk of infecting plants in the future. So it's just a matter of how deliberate are we in moving our plants or sterilizing that soil or letting the soil kind of just rest for years maybe before you go back to tomatoes. You know, and then there's always the spraying and trying to put a protectant on the plant itself to minimize that infection as the growing season progresses. Now, most people don't like to spray their vegetables, myself included. So I just kind of let the disease run its course and, you know, take what I get. But when you've got a really bad infestation, you can't seem to, you know, get around it. Sometimes we just have to stop growing tomatoes in that spot, especially in a raised bed where it's confined, and just grow other plants for maybe 3 or 4 years and then go back to solanaceous, you know, plants. So it's a tough one, but it happens every year.
And you can join in too, 800-642-1234. Glenn in Cedar, Michigan, up next. Hi, Glenn.
Now, hello you. How are you?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Yeah, thanks for your show. I love tuning in from over here in Michigan. Epsom salt is magnesium sulfate. It's a magnesium salt.
Yes, yes, yes.
And I don't really know about using that, but I do. I was reading a book from back in the mid-1800s by a fellow named Waring out of the University of Pennsylvania on agricultural techniques. And apparently using plain old salt, calcium chloride, wasn't they did it in certain situations. Salt was used, and I'm not a farmer, and I'm aspiring. But this is what I know.
All right. Glenn, thank you.
Leave it to Wisconsin Public Radio listeners to keep us all on track and honest. And, yes, magnesium sulfate is Epsom salt. So knowing the chemistry of that now, it's a salt, obviously, and there's good and bad things that come with salts. When we add those to the soil, we get the salt index they often reference. So, you know, you can overdo it. But if you feel your tomato plants in that earlier question are going to benefit from the magnesium, well, that's one way you can get it. Now, one thing that might happen is the sulfur could actually cause the soil to become acidic, I believe. Yeah. I'm not 100% sure there, but you've got sulfur. Well, you know, plants need sulfur too. So, you know, it's a type of fertilizer, and in some cases, maybe that's a good thing to do.
Glenn, thank you very much for calling. On to Thomas in Manitowoc. Hi, Thomas.
Hi, I was wondering, I watched a television program, and they were growing tomatoes on a third-generation tomato farm in California, and they had hundreds of acres on them growing right on the ground, and they grow those tomatoes there year after year after year. How do they do that?
Yeah, how do you do that successfully? Kevin, there's...
Yeah, I would say, when we do commercial production of just about anything, I mean, there is... there's an awful lot that has to be taken into consideration that we as home gardeners don't necessarily even consider. When you put all your eggs in one basket like that, I am almost positive they're going to run into some, buildup of any number of pests and, just other issues when we do monocultures. And we do them all the time. It's part of our, commodity and commercial agricultural system. And, once we're in that kind of monoculture environment, they're probably doing things that are trying to mitigate and minimize some of those impacts from disease buildup and any number of other environmental things that are going to happen from that, year after year after year rotation. And my guess is, that these are not organically raised and organically certified tomatoes because it just wouldn't work to do that, to be certified and to be an organic grower under those situations. So my guess is that they are, using any number of spray products to manage diseases and to keep the plants healthy. And this is just part of our agricultural system. I mean, we can't produce the bushels and bushels of tomatoes without some of these technologies. And it's a slippery slope, I understand it. There are some people who say we can feed the world organically, and there's other people who say you can't. And, so it is what it is, and you just have to accept the fact that it does work. We have technologies that lend themselves to monocultures, and we can produce lots of food with that, but it comes at a cost. And, that's for us as consumers to decide. And as a commercial grower, they know how to do it based off of that system, and that's business, right?
Yeah, there we go. Thank you, Thomas, for that question. Jeff in Superior will turn to you next. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, thank you, and good afternoon. I have, when I was a kid growing up, my grandpa used to spend a lot of time telling me stories about his family farm. His mother came over from Sweden and worked for Martin Pattison up here and then married a guy and bought a farm. And he told me that, like 100 years ago, they grew a lot of hops on the farm. So, in the 60s when I was with him, we were like still pulling out the vines of the hops, and because the hops would grow and come back every year a lot. And he said that years ago, hops was a popular crop, and they didn't just use it for beer, but he didn't really tell me more about that. Can you grow hops up here in northern Wisconsin, and is it a good idea, and what would you use them for besides beer?
Well, hops has kind of gotten a little bit of a resurgence in Wisconsin recently, and you're right, hops traditionally is thought of as a plant that can be used in the beer-making process. And I think that's been the driver for most of our past commercial hops production. We do have a strong or a long, beer making culture and history in Wisconsin. And I think the reason hops were grown here back in the 1800s were to support that, growing brewing industry. And there was disease issues and all kinds of other things that forced it to leave the state, and it's moved to other places that don't have the same disease issues we have. And well, now with the microbrew and all the other industries that are wanting to grow hops locally, we're seeing more hops grown in Wisconsin again. As far as can it grow this far north, i.e. Douglas County and far northern parts of the state, just like any plant, you got to understand the days to maturity, and there's some hop varieties that are probably longer maturity than others. So, you got to keep that in mind. What's our growing season like up here, and what varieties might work best? As far as other uses, I really, off the top of my head, I can't think of any other than the primary reason is in the brewing industry, but it's an interesting plant.
It grows.
It does.
So, does it ever grow?
Yep. And there's people that are just growing it to experiment with it, or maybe to do, have some for their backyard, local beer. People are into beer making. They can grow their own hops.
Yeah, so, we've had guests on from Gorst Valley Hops, and those guys really know what they're doing, and they work with a lot of farmers. They actually do education programs and contract with these farmers for the hops, and they know really the ins and outs of growing it and harvesting it and getting it to the brewers. They do a really good job, and I'm pretty sure there are some other organizations in the state that do it as well, but I just know the Gorst Valley Hops folks do a particularly good job. You could probably go to their website, Gorst, G-O-R-S-T, Gorst Valley Hops would be a place to go for some more information about the hop industry here in the state.
And there are colleagues of mine in UW Extension that have been following this trend in this industry for many, many years, and they typically put on at least one or two Extension-sponsored events on hop production, specifically, I think, with the Wisconsin craft brewery industry in mind. One of those would be Carl Dooley in Buffalo County. I know has been a big proponent of that. But if you go online and do like internet search on hops production, UW Extension, you're going to get a bunch of stuff.
And I just had to, Jill just let me know that Kate Archer Candace posted a caterpillar picture from up your neck of the woods. I think it's turns into a cecropia moth, maybe?
Yes. That's the beauty of having a outdoor classroom outside your office. That teaching and display garden has a monarch and pollinator sanctuary perennial garden that was recently renovated for pollinators, including butterflies. And lo and behold, this past week we were out there, our master gardeners were out there doing some renovations, and I have to swing by and give them, you know, my thanks and whatnot. And sure enough, one of them stumbled across this huge caterpillar and went over there, and I'll be darned, there was two of them actually on a New Jersey tea. It's a forb annual perennial plant, a native, and they were like 4 inches long and just beautiful. It's one of our largest caterpillar moths, and it was just so interesting to see that because you don't run across that every day.
No, you sure don't. And that's up on our Ideas Network Facebook page if you want to take a look at the photos that Kevin got of that caterpillar, cecropia moth caterpillar. It's pretty darn cool, kind of a mint green almost, and it's got those gold little spikes that are coming out of it that look pretty attractive, really. We have Werner in Wauwatosa next. Werner, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. I got a question. We put in a raised bed garden here in Wauwatosa when we moved in 5 years ago because we had a black walnut tree nearby. And we put in dirt that was 50% black dirt and 50% manure, which is wonderful because I'm a big believer in manure, but our tomatoes end up being uncontrollable because when you take them out in the fall, they're 11 feet long, and it's kind of like hard to even manage them in the summer. We had the soil tested by the state, and all they said was apply half a pound of nitrogen fertilizer, and that's all. Any idea how to kind of tone down the dirt?
Well, this might be one of those cases of too much of a good thing. And that's where our plants, they tell us, you know, things if we're watching them. And in this case, when we see all that vigor and all that growth, that indicates, at least to me, that, you know, despite what the soil test says, and, you know, and this is where our soil test can only do so much with the, you know, with the information that we get from that analysis. But my guess is that there's adequate nitrogen given the fact that you've got, you know, such a rich soil. I imagine it's awfully dark in color. So there's probably more than enough nitrogen and nutrients for those tomatoes. And I really would not necessarily in this case follow the recommendations of that soil test because our plants are already telling us that they're more than happy with the amount of nutrients they're getting. And nitrogen does cause really long, vigorous growth. And so I definitely wouldn't be going out of my way to add more nitrogen. And
no.
you know, that's just the consequences of what you've done. It's a good thing, but in this case, maybe too much. So
there you go. Thanks, Werner, for calling. George in Hartford, your turn. Hi, George.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Kevin. Kevin, you may not remember, I'm your old ag teacher from Hartford High School.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, George. Yes, yes, yes.
And it makes me proud to see somebody go on to be famous despite having been in one of my classes.
There you go.
I do have a legitimate question, though. Our church has a community garden. We put in 45 raised plots that are each 15 feet by 20 feet. And, of course, the Japanese beetles has arrived. They seem to be somewhat selective in the plots that they choose, but they chew the living daylights out of the leaves when they are there. Do you have any suggestions of what we can do other than some of our gardeners have used soapy water to get them off? So do you have any suggestions for our community garden, I guess?
Yes, I do. And this subject came up at the top of the hour, and we didn't have a chance necessarily to get too far into that. And wouldn't you know, now I lost my source that I found on the internet. If you do an internet search on Japanese beetle, and it was a recent article that was posted on UW Context, I think that's what it's called. Mm-hmm. It's just another one of our ways of getting information out there. But my colleague VJ Pandian is the one that kind of summarized what your options are when it comes to Japanese beetle. One of our challenges is, you know, we can certainly control them with an insecticide, any number of them, but they are not bee friendly like most insecticides. So that's the last resort of treating for Japanese beetle. In this case, perhaps, and this is where, again, it's always time and money or resources when it comes to managing things, you could put a floating row cover over the plants that you really want to protect, provided they don't need to be pollinated. So, you know, that's a physical barrier. It's going to keep the Japanese beetles off. Hand picking and all that kind of, you know, labor work is another option. But you've got 45 plots, a lot of area, thousands of beetles, I'm assuming. So, you know, that might not be the best thing to do. The row covers might only work in certain beds and certain plants. Then you're going to the option of, you know, if they are doing significant damage, that they pass a threshold, you know, and like the earlier caller on grapes, the threshold is really, really high on grapes, and you can withstand all kinds of defoliation this time of year for the most part. But on a vegetable plant, it doesn't take long, perhaps, to really ruin the crop if you've got high numbers. So this is where we got to think strategically about how we're going to do that. And there are some more bee-friendly products. Spinosad is one. I also think in that article, VJ mentioned BT. So go online, check out that Japanese beetle article with UW Context in the title. You should find it. It was more recent post, so it should be more up-to-date than maybe some other information that's out there. Tough critter.
Yeah, and Kevin, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. It was a lot of fun. I really appreciate it. Kevin Schesso, the Ag Area Development Agent for UW Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties. And don't forget about the Twilight Garden Tour at the Spooner Ag Research Station Tuesday, October 14th from 4 to 7:30. It's going to be a lot of fun. And thank you for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store.